Shabbat Shalom and welcome to United Israel World Union. This is our Sabbath morning Torah study. It is great to be here with you. It looks like it's going to be a rainy day here in St. Francisville, so I told them, the group that is in here, that we have to I have to keep it lively today. Otherwise, they might go to sleep. We have a metal roof and the rain. You know how those two go together. Hey, it's Shabbat, so it is a time for people to come together, and it's a holy day. It's a holy convocation. It is a time where we come together and we are refreshed, and it is lovely to be here with you today. We are working through, according to the ancient triennial Torah portions, the book of Genesis, the book of beginnings. So some of you who are just logging on, every week I get emails from people who just found us, and I'm not sure how that happens. I guess people just search and they get blessed and find us, or however you want to put that. But we are working through this ancient cycle of readings. Many people who follow the Torah readings are following the annual cycle of readings. And you would be in the book of Bamidbar, in the book of Numbers, but we are in, I believe, our 27th week in the book of Genesis, in the book of beginnings, and we're only in chapter 30. So basically what this allows us to do is to take chapter by chapter. It's almost chapter, breaking down by chapter. It gives us time to dig deeper and to look at these stories in a little bit closer way and perhaps see some things that we might otherwise miss. One other point on this is that when I began studying the triennial portion of readings, I realized that whenever you teach according to the annual cycle of readings, you might be covering five or six chapters, and I would get in a habit every week, year after year, of choosing those select things that I liked. And the things that I didn't like, or the things that were a little bit questionable or a little uneasy for me to talk about, I'd just blow over it. I'd skip it. And this forces me to not do that. And so some of these lessons, some of these chapters that we study, lend themselves to teaching a lot easier than others. Some have things and you read them and you think, wow, what am I going to teach on in this? But all of the Torah is instructive if we truly know what we're looking for and if we pray for guidance. So we're in the life of Yaakov. We're in the life of Jacob. And Jacob is one of the patriarchs, obviously. We have Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And Jacob is my favorite because he's a little bit wild. He does some things that are questionable. Some people look at him and they have problems. But Jacob is a colorful character, is one way to put it. At the beginning of this particular portion, we have the birth of Joseph, of Yosef, the son, the first son of Jacob and Rachel. And we don't get a lot of information about Joseph in this particular story. We're just introduced to his birth. It occurs at the very beginning. It's not really mentioned. It's not highlighted. We don't really get a glimpse of just who this Joseph is. But we're just introduced to him. He's born. We'll talk a little bit about the character of Joseph as we progress in the teaching. But when we get to the Joseph saga, I like to call it, where the focus shifts again towards the life of Joseph, I think that all of us will be quite enlightened, because Joseph, like his fathers in many ways, and I'll talk about this today, represents not just himself, but a group of people who descend from him. So Joseph is quite the biblical character. You know, a lot of people, even people who aren't aficionados of Scripture, who aren't really that into the Bible, love the stories of Joseph. If you ever pick up a children's study Bible, those quote-unquote Old Testament parts, Joseph's stories are all through there. It's because the world loves the story of Joseph. But in this week, all we learn is that he's born. We don't get much beyond that. Following immediately the birth of Yosef to Rachel, following that birth, almost immediately what we get in the story is a request from Jacob to leave his position of servitude. Now, one of the things that I like to do as I read through these stories carefully is look for pictures. I'm not so much into types and shadows. I used to be really into this. Now I like to take things at face value. Here's what it says. Let's see what it says. Let's not try to make it mean something it doesn't. But nonetheless, whenever I look at these stories, I look for the steps in the template, if you will. Like in this particular story of today's reading, we have the birth or the, let's say, the appearance on the scene of Joseph. And then shortly thereafter, we have a request to leave slavery. All right, so begin to think with me if you can follow my train of thinking here. Joseph shows up, and then shortly thereafter, there's a request to leave the servitude with his women. He is enslaved to the father of his women. Again, I like to point this out. There's no word in Hebrew for wife. It's a man and his woman. And so I think a lot of translations pick that up. What am I saying? Not saying anything other than the word there is woman. So he's got two women. He's got actually four women because he also has the handmaids that were given to the women by Laban, by the father. This week's story leaves out some important information. Let me qualify that. Leaves out might not be the way to put it. We are introduced to a snapshot in the life of Jacob, and we're not given all the details. We have some of the details that come next week. Now, if I were a better teacher, I might be able to present the story and keep you in suspense. But I want to pull some of that forward to this week. Not because I don't think that the student can't handle it or that the teacher can't come up with something to say here, but I want to bring the two together because without this information, we're left to our own devices and we might miss a couple of details. So I just hint at that now. I'll bring it in a little while, and I think it'll make better sense. Like the patriarchs, like Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and even the tribes, Joseph, Judah, all these others, we do get pictures from studying the lives of these patriarchal figures, and we get a little insight into their descendants as we work through these stories. There's a Jewish saying that goes something like this, I'm paraphrasing, that the life of the children is exhibited in the lives of the fathers. In other words, by studying the lives of these patriarchs, we begin to get a little bit of insight into the lives of the descendants. What happens to the fathers happens to the sons. It's like history repeats itself. You know, there's this idea in Ecclesiastes. It first appears in chapter 1, verse 9. It says, "What has been is what shall be. There's nothing new under the sun." So if you want to study what's going to happen, you look at what already happened. So here's an idea I like to make sure that people get. I don't know how many times I've met people who want to jump right into studying prophecy. And I'm okay with that. I don't say you have to be 40 years old. You don't have to. I mean, I still have my 1972 picture Bible that I got for a Christmas many, 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 many years ago. And I can tell you from the markings in it that I was into Revelation. And in 72, I must have been a year or two old. I'll let you do that math. That's a joke. I wasn't. But I was a kid. I was a little boy. But people want to jump into prophecy. But what they tend to miss is prophecy is not what people assume that it is. And I think that quite often, if you don't get these foundational stories, these bedrock truths, what you do is you tend to leap and make incorrect assumptions. So we try not to do that here. So the life of the patriarchs tends to model, if you will, the life of the descendants. Now, so we have Joseph appearing on the scene. We have a request to leave slavery. And then we have this interesting story, let's call it interesting, that tells us one thing. The children will not leave empty-handed. So you can see there are certain themes. Where does that bring me? I'm thinking about another Exodus where Joseph is involved, where we have a request to leave, and where they don't leave empty-handed. That is modeled for the first time here. Okay? So hopefully that will come into play and we'll begin to see things based on that. But, by the way, this idea of not leaving empty-handed is thanks to the God who guides the happenings associated with Abraham's children throughout the ages. There is a God that guides the events and circumstances in the lives of the patriarchs and the people that he has chosen. He is behind the scenes working, orchestrating, and leading his people, and that will become evident at every page turn. All right. Now, we're talking about the births, the beginnings of a people, a chosen people, one man's family, as James Tabor often puts it. We're talking about one man's family, the seed of Abraham, my friend. Isaiah chapter 41, verse 8 calls Abraham the friend of God. 2 Chronicles chapter 20 and verse 7 says the same thing. And the book of James in the Christian writings also refers to Abraham as God's friend. We're talking about the family of the one who is called the friend of God, where the word friend is actually tied to the root word ahav, which means to love. So it's the beloved of God. So Amos will say this once, that you, speaking on behalf of Jehovah, you alone, talking to Israel, have I known of all the families of the earth. We're talking about this family. A family that's guided, a family who is called a segulah, a special treasure, a chosen nation, a holy nation, a nation of priests, a covenant of the people, light unto the nations. But it begins here. It begins with a select group of people. Now, a lot of people are uneasy. Even Jewish people that I know are a little bit uneasy with this whole chosenness idea. You know, people are like, well, you know, I don't know that I want to be. You know, it's like the scene in my favorite movie, Fiddler on the Roof, where the quote is, maybe you could choose someone else. You know, it's like, this is a tough gig. But why are they chosen? I listed off some of the reasons, but interestingly enough, in Deuteronomy chapter 7, God will say to the people of Israel, the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, he says, look, it's not that you're more numerous, because you're not. You're one of the smallest. You're, like Mark Twain calls it, a speck of stardust. You're small. You're insignificant in many ways. But it's because of the oath that he swore to the fathers. He says over and over, because I loved your fathers with everything that made them who they were. As a parent, I understand this. You know, sometimes children, probably not you guys in here, but some children don't always do exactly what the... But see, that doesn't take away your love for them. So God says, because he loved the fathers. And that's why I enjoy studying these stories, because it's a love that goes beyond the behavior of the children. It's a chosenness. You can't get away from it. You will do what it is that God called you to do. And that's the lesson of these patriarchal narratives. Israel is to become a goy gadol, a great nation. A goy gadol. He tells this first to Abraham. I will make of you a goy gadol. You will be great. You'll be a blessing, and you'll bless others, and so forth and so on. But what does it take to become a goy gadol, a great nation? Again, it begins with the foundations. It begins with the fathers. So we're in the life of Yaakov. Yaakov is in many ways the black sheep of the family, you might say. By the way, we're talking about colored sheep today, so it's appropriate that I would talk about Jacob as a black sheep. Might be talking about speckled and spotted, but you get the point. The idea is that Jacob has certain qualities about him that sometimes people look at and say, not sure what I think about O Jacob. I mean, his name is the supplanter, the one who grabs the heel, if you will. And throughout his life, he learns, his character is polished. I don't think he ever loses that fire. It either the things that he was born with, that supplanting, are either things that he does to other people or things that other people do to him. But it seems to stick with him all of his life. Once again, in our story today, we recognize that a miracle is required in order to bring about this goy gadol, this great nation. Once again, just like it was in Sarah, in the case of Sarah, in the case of Rivka, in Rebecca's case, in the case of Leah, we don't tend to think of Leah. I did last week was Leah's cry, basically, you know, giving things from her perspective. We don't think of Leah as having a problem bearing children. She's fertile. I mean, she's it's almost like, according to the story, anytime she goes into the tent with Jacob, she gets pregnant. I mean, that's the way we tend to think. But what we miss, if we're not careful, is that God opened her womb because he saw she was hated. So even there, don't attribute that to just, she's just fertile and she... No, that too is a miracle. And it's a miracle because of God's grace. He sees that she's hated, he opens her womb, and then she is very, very fruitful. But so it is with Rachel in the sense that it requires yet again miraculous intervention in order to bring about the birth of this great nation. And that's where our story begins. Again, the miraculous is truly commonplace when it comes to Israel. I think it was David Ben-Gurion that in order to be a realist in Israel, you have to believe in miracles. And that applied anciently as well as in the modern day. You know, you can't look at modern day Israel and say, I don't believe in miracles. I mean, it becomes difficult. Let's just say it's difficult. I have people that will tell me, I respect Israel as a modern entity. You know, I just don't believe all that Bible stuff. You're like, really? I mean, how do you do that? It becomes difficult to separate the things that we see in the modern world. Do you think for 1 minute that if there wasn't some sort of miraculous protection for the state of Israel that they would still exist? You know, people would attribute it to a mighty military, but I think most of the religious people in Israel would say, be careful. It's not by sword. It's not by horse. You know, they would quote the prophets, right? And I've heard that in many settings where they would say that. So, but by the end of today's story, what we read about is that the relationship between Jacob and Laban is seemingly strained. Not that it was ever perfect, but by the time we reach the end of today's reading, we see that things are becoming more difficult. It becomes more difficult to live with one another. And this seems to be a repetitive theme in the life of Jacob. Not that he intentionally does this, but at times he sort of wears out his welcome, maybe through no fault of his own. When I was a kid, I would spend the night at someone's house. My mom would come get me like at 8 a.m., so I wouldn't wear out my welcome. The other people are like, my God, the woman's coming that early. Maybe we could sleep in. But this idea that you don't overstay your stay, and Jacob tends to push that, or maybe said a better way, by the time Jacob moves, it's time for Jacob to move. It's always time for Jacob to move. When he packs his bags, people are ready for him to go. That's just the way it is with Jacob. Once again, Jacob may need to leave his residence, and it may not be on the best of terms. And that's just the way it goes with Jacob. The reading contains a very, very strange tale. And I don't know how to call it other than to say it's strange. It comes across almost as sort of a folklorish belief in magical things, or if you don't quite know what I'm talking about, it's this idea of stripping poplar branches and putting them before certain animals when they're mating, and then the animals during the mating process will look at the sticks and they'll take on the colors of the... I mean, when I read this, I think, what's going on here? Is it saying that this will happen if you put the sticks with the strips, or was it a belief? You know, I mean, commentators are all over the place, and some of them speak real matter-of-factly, like, well, this was an ancient belief, and where do you get this? Where do you find this? Who says this is an ancient belief? It just comes across in the story sort of matter-of-fact. He puts these sticks in front of the animals, and they mate, and out come these animals. It seems sort of fast. We know gestational periods are longer than what the story seems to present, but it seems like there's a connection between what they see and what they produce. And if we were left to go with that, we might have difficulty with some of the interpretive things, or we might go further than we need to go. But, and the reason that I'm going to bring in something from a later reading is that, forget all of that about there being some ancient belief in stripped down poplar branches, and just recognize that he has a vision. God speaks to him in a dream. Sticks are something else. We'll go through that. But if you didn't have the sticks, the miracle would still take place. All right, and it could be, I want you to listen to this as we read the story, it could be that Jacob is in some way demonstrating with these sticks the realization of the vision that is to come to pass. Don't know, but that's one of those things that we'll just talk about as we go through. Again, we see hints and allusions to a later departure of not the man Jacob, but of his descendants from servitude. We'll see sort of overtures of that throughout this reading. So, if you will join with me, I'd like to read to you the story from the Transparent English Bible, and follow along in whatever Bible you have. If you've not been with us before, this translation is very literal. It's called the Transparent English Bible because the idea behind James Tabor's work is that you will look at the English, and it is so close to what the Hebrew reflects. It's very literal. It's rhythmic. And so it's much more literal. He doesn't try to smooth out like a lot of translators do. It is what it is. And as we read it, you'll see that. So we're going to begin in chapter 30 of the book of Genesis. Chapter 30 and verse 22 is where our reading begins today. And it begins, "And Elohim remembered Rachel, and Elohim hearkened toward her, and he opened her womb. And she became pregnant and brought forth a son, and said, Elohim has gathered my reproach. And she called his name Joseph, saying, May Jehovah cause to be continued to me another son. And it was as Rachel had brought forth Joseph, and Jacob said toward Laban, Send me, and I will walk toward my place and to my land. Give my women and my ones brought forth for whom I have served you, and I will walk for you." If you notice, anytime it's bold type in this translation, in the Hebrew, it's repeated. So it would say, for you, "You know my service, that I have served you." And Laban said toward him, "If please I have found favor in your eyes, I have prognosticated that Jehovah has blessed me on account of you." And he said, fix your wage upon me, and I will give. And he said toward him, you know that for which I have served you, and that which your acquired livestock with me, for little that was to you before my face. And it burst forth to an abundance. Jehovah has blessed you at my foot, and now when will I do also for my house? And he said, what will I give to you? And Jacob said, you will not give to me anything. I'm reminded of what Abraham said at the closing of the battle in Genesis 14. I won't take so much as a shoelace from you. You're not going to give me anything. Notice what he says. You will not give to me anything. If you do this to me, I will return, I will pasture your flock, I will guard, and let me pass over with all your flock today, turning aside from there every small one of the flock, speckled and spotted, and every small one of the flock, brown among the lambs and spotted and speckled among the goats, it will be my wage, and my justness or my righteousness will answer for me in the day of tomorrow when the matter concerning my wage comes before your face. Everyone that is not speckled and spotted among the goats and brown among the lambs, it will be as stolen with me. And Laban said, look, oh, let it be according to your spoken thing. And he turned aside that day the male goats striped and spotted, and all the female goats striped and spotted, every one that had white in it, and every brown one among the lambs, and he gave them into the hand of his sons. And he placed a way of 3 days between himself and between Jacob, and Jacob pastured the flock of Laban the remaining. Jacob took for himself a rod of poplar, moist, and of almond, and plain, and peeled white peelings in them, making bare the white that is upon the rods. And he set the rods that he peeled in the troughs in the gutters of waters where the flocks came to drink to the front of the flock, and they became heated in their coming to drink. And the flock became heated toward the rods, and the flocks brought forth striped, speckled, and spotted ones. And lambs Jacob separated, and he gave the face of the flock toward the stripe and all the brown in the flock of Laban. And he set for himself the droves by itself, and he did not set them upon the flock of Laban. And it was in every heating of the flock of the strong ones. And Jacob placed the rods to the eyes of the flock in the troughs to heat them by the rods. And with the feebler of the flock, he did not place them. And it was the ones being feeble were to Laban, the ones being strong were to Jacob. And the man burst forth exceedingly, exceedingly, and it was to him abundant flocks and house servants and servants and camels and donkeys. Always in my mind, I always say, oh my, when I read that. And he heard the spoken things of the sons of Laban, saying, Jacob has taken all that was to our father, and from that which was to our father, he has made all this weight. Jacob saw the face of Laban, and look, it was not with him as yesterday and a third. Very literal. He sees there are some accusations floating around. Look at this. Everything that was our father's, by the way, this is the first time we understand that Laban has sons. So there's a question as to who are these? Are these nephews, are they actually literally sons? But it's the first time we've heard about this, and we've known Laban a little while. But they're accusing him of stealing their father's wealth. Now, that's not what happens, but it sure looks like it. And so this is where we are at. Last week's reading was all about Leah. You might expect that this week we get all about Rachel, but we don't. We get very little about Rachel, actually, and that becomes the rule. We just don't learn a lot about Rachel. In fact, we learn as much about Rachel in Leah's reading last week, and we don't get much more. So we don't this week say, well, Leah had her week last week, and now we're going to learn about Rachel. But what we do get is important. What we do get is important, and we do get some traces. And you'll see today, I'll touch on some things quite prophetic at the end of the class, probably I'll get to this, about Rachel and about her singular importance, as well as Joseph's, and how this is all a prophetic picture, like I tried to make the point as I introduced today's reading. There is this connection between the people, the patriarchs and the matriarchs and their descendants. But what we do get is important. The reading begins this way, and it says, "And Elohim remembered Rachel." And Elohim remembered Rachel. When you read that, you could almost think that he had forgotten her. Because we tend to think in black and white and opposites. Like, in order to remember something, you must have forgotten it previously, you know. The word zakar does mean to call to mind, to remember. And this phrase is used four times in Scripture. Whenever it says, like if you look up this precise phrase, and Elohim remembered, that phrase is four times. Now, Jehovah is associated with the word remember quite a few times, but generally it's a person saying to God, remember me. Don't forget us. Don't, you know, but whenever it says an Elohim remembered four times, first time is with Noah. In Genesis chapter 8, verse 1, Genesis 8, 1, that's the first time. And I just want to touch on these. And actually, if you begin in chapter 7, verse 24 of Genesis, and when the waters had swelled on the earth 150 days, God remembered Noah and all the beasts and all the cattle that were with him in the ark. And God caused a wind to blow across the earth, and the waters subsided. The idea is, it could be, in other words, I understand that people could go, oh, he must have forgot him for 150 days. It's more that he calls to mind the situation and he focuses his redemptive efforts once again on the one that he chose. Notice it's not just on Noah, but he remembers the animals as well. So, you know, a lot of people who don't have a very high opinion of animals, you're like, well, he saved eight people and a whole bunch of animals, so be careful, right? The idea is that God calls to mind this particular family who is to bring about redemption. It's associated with covenant. This is something I want you to know. When God remembers, it's associated with covenant. And so that's an important thing to think about. Now, another, the second time that we find and God remembered is in chapter 19 of Genesis, verse 29. Now, this is after the destruction. Once again, we have it's after the destruction. So what are we learning here? Something's going on. Maybe there's a pattern. Thus it was that when God destroyed the cities of the plain and annihilated the cities where Lot dwelt, God was mindful, literally in the Hebrew, same exact phrase as what we read in Genesis 8. God remembered Abraham and removed Lot from the midst of the upheaval. So whatever it means, again, we have an association of God's redemption and salvation tied with his calling to mind of his people or those who are associated with his people, maybe, right? The third time is in our story today, and it's Rachel. Rachel is the only mother or female or woman in Scripture. The other two examples we just read are men, but he remembers her. And I believe that once again, though we don't know it yet, we'll see that this time the recalling or the remembrance of Rachel is also associated with salvation and redemption of his people. It's tied to his plan. Now, so let me skip forward to Exodus chapter 2. The only mention of Elohim remembering outside the book of Genesis. And it's in Exodus chapter 2, verse 24. And it says, let's read 23 as well. A long time after that, the king of Egypt died. The Israelites were groaning under their bondage and cried out, and their cry for help from bondage rose up to God. God heard their moaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. God looked upon the Israelites and took notice of them. To me, this is a very gripping passage. The people are crying out in their servitude. And we don't know at all times, we don't always get that God's remembrance is associated with the cry of his people. But I have to wonder if after 150 days, if the family within inside the vessel had not begun to cry out. I mean, I have to wonder. I mean, please understand, I'm very scriptural. I'm a text guy. I'm a Bible guy. I'm not saying this. I'm just suggesting. It could be. The same with the destruction. Imagine Abraham seeing the destruction off in the distance of Sodom and Gomorrah, and he thinks about his family, Lot. And it says, and God remembered Abraham. And then, of course, we know that Rachel has been crying out for a child. But it seems that in each of these cases, the remembrance, God's memory is associated with his promises. Put me in, how does it put it? I'll have to look at the Hebrew in Isaiah where it says, put me in remembrance of my word, basically. So those are the four instances, Noah, Abraham, Rachel, and his covenant, all having to do, in, at least in some way, with salvation, redemption. And we might include furtherance of the plan. In other words, it indicates in his recalling to mind that the plan must go on. So that might be another thing to think about. Today, we read that according to the Torah says that Elohim did three things. He remembered Rachel. He hearkened to her, indicating that she has cried out to him, and he opens her womb. So her prayer and the resolution of her problem is kind of encapsulated in that. I think we ought to think about that in our own daily life too. In order to gain God's hearing, we have to cry out to him. I mean, it's the way it is. If you read through the book of Judges, and the people cried out and God sent them a savior. You know, it's one of those, hey, you don't have because you don't ask. Ask. I think a lot of times people think that, well, God knows, and their prayer life suffers because they figure, well, God already knows what I need. Surely he's watching my miserable state. And so we don't even ask. But I think it's important. It's not like you don't think that you're doing this because he doesn't know and you need to tell him. But it's an exercise in our faith, I believe. So once again, we have a miraculous intervention when it comes to the birth of and the beginnings of this holy nation, this people that are called for a very significant role in humankind's history. You'll recall that Rachel had sought the aid of magic, if you will. She's desperate. I mean, she has been crying for a child. She can't conceive. She wants a child so badly. And remember in last week's story in chapter 30, verse 14, Reuven has been out in the field and he finds some mandrakes. And he brings the mandrakes back And these mandrakes are thought to possess certain powers, to be like an aphrodisiac or to cause conception. I mean, there are all sorts of things. I don't know the first thing about a mandrake, and as far as personal knowledge of it. But, you know, some others out there, it's like everything that I looked up said, oh, this is believed to have this, you know, so I don't know. I mean, but it was believed to. She wanted those so badly, it seems, as I pointed out last week, that the normal sleeping arrangement was that Jacob would sleep with Rachel. And then from time to time sleep with Leah and she'd get pregnant. Then he'd sleep with Rachel again. But Rachel was willing to give up her man, which she's pretty much claimed for herself, for this one night to get these mandrakes. But here's a little secret for you. God don't need no mandrakes. And neither does Rachel, as it turns out. Because that's not what caused the pregnancy. It doesn't appear that Jacob needs any bidding to sleep with her. That's not the issue. It doesn't appear that that's what's been holding her, a lack of mandrake in her diet, from conceiving. It wasn't time yet. Here's something that I thought about. Joseph will become manifest when the time is right and not before. Joseph will show up when it's good and ready time for Joseph to show up. And you can take that throughout history into prophecy. Joseph will not come until it's time for Joseph to come. So some of you might read more into that than others, but I think that those who study Scripture might catch the hint. We are learning. If we're not paying attention. We should be learning. Let's say that as we work through these stories, that the plan, capital T, capital P, the plan will come, it will pass to whom it is intended, regardless of our mistakes or missteps, right? Mm-hmm. So if the father or mother has a favorite child and seeks to pass the plan on to someone else that it's not intended, it won't work. It won't work. It's only going to pass to whom it's intended, and it doesn't matter what happens or has to happen to make that happen. It's going to happen the way it's supposed to happen. Is that enough use of the word happen? And it's going to happen at the time it is supposed to happen. So it's going to go to whom it is intended at the time it is prescribed on a clock that we can't see. And there's no magic required. When we talk about timing, I think about Isaac and his 20 years of prayer. 20 years praying for Rivka that she would conceive. 20 years. Look, there's something about this 20-year time frame. Because it appears that Jacob has been working in servitude for 20 years as well, roughly. You know, you got the 14. It's been about, by the time he leaves Laban, it's going to be about 20 years. I think we tend to read these stories, especially reading through the annual cycle of reading. You're just like, oh, he goes to Laban. He has a bunch of kids. They go home. No. He went there, you know, as a young man, and he leaves gray-headed. I mean, it's one of those a little bit longer than what we think about. There's no magic required. When I think about this, it's orchestrated by the unseen hand. One of the things that we find in the patriarchs and in their life stories and in the story where Eliezer, or actually we don't know it's Eliezer, I misspoke there. We just know that it's Abraham's servant. When he goes to get a woman for Isaac, it says that one of the phrases that he uses, he says this. He says, make something happen before my face today. He recognizes that God is going to orchestrate this meeting. And I told you when I taught that class, we ought to live our lives with that expectancy as well. It's one of those things where you go through your daily life, but don't doubt that God can't move on your behalf. Don't expect it to happen like that, as it may or may not. It can. It might be 20 years, so don't give up. Joseph, again, very little at this point. Very little. There's no way of predicting at this point, unless you've read the rest of the story, which hopefully most of you have, but there's no way of predicting based on our introduction to Joseph that he has any singular importance in the story. I mean, we already have 10 sons and a daughter, but I like to think about when we look at, for instance, the story of King David, when the prophet goes to the house of Jesse in Bethlehem, and one after another, the boys are brought before the prophet because he's going to anoint someone, and everyone who was present, I don't know how many people were in the room, but the prophet, Samuel, says, "Surely the Lord's anointed is before me." You know, he's looking. This is a nice looking. He's strapping. He's a big guy. He's handsome. He's a total package. This is the Lord's. Nope, not him. Next one. Nope, not him. Nope, I haven't chosen him. And then Samuel looks around and he says, "Is there anyone else? Do you have any more kids?" "Oh, yeah, there's the, you know, David. I mean, David, he's out there playing with the sheep. Go get him." And then he realizes the Lord's anointed is before him. You see, because we get a valuable thing there. What we learn in that story in Samuel is that God doesn't see the way we see. He doesn't look at the outside. He looks at the inside. And what he saw in David was something that others had missed. The people that were closest to him missed it. When we read the story of Joseph, when we first meet with him, he's just one of a big family. But God's going to use Joseph in a very, very incredible way. And I would say even now, God is going to use Joseph in a very, very incredible way. But we'll learn more about Joseph as we go. All we know, really, if you look at Genesis 30, just to touch this before we move on, Genesis 30, beginning in verse 22, "And God remembered Rachel," Genesis 30, 22, "God heeded her and opened her womb. She conceived and bore a son and said, 'God has taken away my disgrace,'" taken away my disgrace. "So she named him Joseph," which is to say, "May Jehovah add another son for me." Now, I want you to think about this because these two clues are associated with the life and role of Joseph. Take away disgrace, or I think Tabor's translation says collect or assemble or gather that disgrace. But it's sort of pull it all together, you know, it's like pull it together. And something about another son, Yosef, to add, right? So we think about this, and then that's all we get. And then the next mention, it says, after Joseph comes, Jacob seeks to leave. I think it is interesting, again, just to point this as we roll through the story, that Joseph arrives in our story, and then immediately thereafter, we have Jacob seeking freedom from slavery. He will play a prominent part in that same story in one other historic event, and I believe one very, very prophetic event that's yet to come. These stories, it's interesting that, again, you want to know what's going to happen? You look at what did happen. And if it happened more than once, we learn this in the story of Joseph later. The fact that a dream comes twice or an event takes place, what does that tell you? It's sort of like putting a stamp on it. So, like, don't be confused. Hello, we did it this way once. We did it this way twice. Probably going to do it that way again, right? Don't get sidetracked. Jacob after Joseph is born, asked to leave and to bring everything with him, women, children, everything that he's acquired, his animals. He's got quite a few now because of this strange little process of mating taking place at the water troughs and the stripped down poplar branches. But Laban has a different idea, and I just want to pick this up. It's actually in next week's reading, but I have to reach over and grab things from there a couple of times today. So go to 31, Genesis 31, verse 43. Laban spoke up and said to Jacob, "The daughters are my daughters, the children are my children, and the flocks are my flocks. All that you see is mine. Yet, what can I do now about my daughters or the children they have borne?" So he's saying, look, everything you have, it's mine. Now, was that sort of an ancient practice? You know, I love reading through, I really don't. These commentators will often, you know, make certain assumptions. Well, this was the ancient practice. Sometimes they're right, sometimes they're not. You're like, how do you know? How do we know that? Now, if they have documentation, if they have the letters that they discovered in an ancient cave that says this, or if we have later Torah legislation, but let's think about that. Look at Exodus 21. Just hit me. Look at Exodus 21. Let's see what the rule is, at least in the Torah, because this is, sometimes these Torah legislations come as a result of something that was messed up in the patriarchal period or something that caused a problem or whatever. But this is in Torah reading Mishpatim. Judgments, if you will. Here's what it says, Exodus 21:1. These are the rules that you shall set before them when you acquire a Hebrew slave. Well, this would kind of be the case with Jacob, right? He shall serve 6 years. In the seventh year, he shall go free. Well, he kind of got him on that one a couple of times. In the seventh year, he shall go free without payment. If he came single, he shall leave single. If he had a wife, his wife shall leave with him. If his master gave him a wife and she has borne him children, the wife and her children shall belong to the master. And he shall leave alone. What? So, in this case, there seems to be an ancient rule here. If you come in empty, you leave in empty. If you bring a woman with you, you get to bring the woman with you when you leave. But if you've acquired a woman and children, they stay, you go. You want to stay? Step up to the door, right? And it continues and talks about this strange little thing that they'll do to your earlobe. But the idea is that if, it looks like Laban's right, all right? So, but that's not the way things are going to pan out, is it? All right? It's just not it. Nonetheless, Jacob says, send me forth. In Hebrew, the root word there is shalak. Send me forth. Some translations say, let me leave. They apply the rule of the jussive in grammar. It's sort of a asking permission. You know, let me leave. But it's really a little bit strong. You're actually saying, send me out of here. You know, send me out. Interestingly enough, in the story of the Exodus, the phrase that's repeated over and over and over, you know, the old "Let my people go" in Charlton Heston in the movie The Exodus or the Ten Commandments, Cecil B. DeMille, and the way most English translations said "Let my people go," in the Hebrew it's shalaketami, send my people forth. Send forth my people. You send them. More of a commanding is the way that I read that. Not, hey, would you let these people go? You know, it doesn't matter how much bass you put in your voice. It's not as strong as send my people forth. So, but this again, I think, is another subtle comparison between the nation of Israel later and their departure and the story and how it's modeled off of this and the life of Jacob. I think this is another example of that. Now, the later legislation, speaking of, look at Deuteronomy 15. Deuteronomy 15, if you ever, you know, really read this, I love this passage. Deuteronomy 15 is an interesting piece of legislation. It talks about taking care of the poor and so forth, very, very strongly worded. It says that there won't be any poor among you, and then it also says there will always be poor among you. And you have to read literally between the lines to figure out why both can be true. But I want to read verse 12 through 15, Deuteronomy 15. If a fellow Hebrew, man or woman, is sold to you, he shall serve you 6 years, in the seventh you shall set him free. When you set him free, get this, do not let him go empty-handed. Furnish him out of the flock, threshing floor, and vat with which Jehovah your God has blessed you. Bear in mind that you were slaves in the land of Egypt, and Jehovah your God redeemed you. Therefore, I enjoin this commandment upon you today. So you like he's saying, based on your blessing, bless the servant. Because you were a servant, you know, I love in the Hebrew Bible, some 30-something times it says to remember the stranger. You were a servant. You know what it feels like. I always try to teach my kids and my grandkids, don't do that to people. You know how it feels when people pick on you, when they make fun of you. You don't want to be that person, so don't make... See, you appeal to their experience. This is what God's doing here. Don't send them out empty. As you're blessed, bless them. One thing we get from the story that's very clearly communicated is that the people of Israel, that Jacob's family has brought blessing to Laban. If it wasn't for Laban, if it wasn't for Jacob, Laban wouldn't have all this blessing. And he admits it. Right? He knows. He recognizes this. So that's the idea. Now, so God will not allow his servant, Jacob, which is a phrase used throughout the prophets, his servant Jacob will not go away empty-handed. By the way, Psalm 105, verses, I think, 12 through 13 or 14, talks about how God would not allow anyone to oppress his prophets or his anointed ones. And he's talking about the people of Israel, the patriarchs. So these are referred to as messiahs and prophets. We'll look at that real quickly, make sure I have exactly the right verse. Psalm 105. So in other words, he's stepping in here. He will step in. Let's see. Yeah, verse 12, Psalm 105. They were then few in number, a mere handful, sojourning there, wandering from nation to nation, from one kingdom to another. He allowed no one to oppress them. He reproved kings on their account. Do not touch my anointed ones, plural, for in Hebrew, Mashach, the Messiah, and do not harm my prophets. Remember very clearly Genesis chapter 20, verse 7, Abraham is called a prophet. So we have to think about that. So God's going to make sure that his chosen ones do not go away empty-handed. What is presented as a scheme of Jacob with an overly magical twist turns out to be another dream-inspired act. Jacob is a dreamer, and Laban asks a price to get him to stay. I mean, think about it. He's got a pretty good deal going. Jacob's built-in servant. He's taken both of the women, both of his daughters off his hands. He's going to provide for them. And he said, look, I don't want you to leave. I guess not. Okay? So he said, what will it take to keep you here? And he tries to negotiate. And Jacob says, you won't give me a thing. I tell you what I'll do. I'll pass through the flock, and you know the story. Now, later, when you read it this week, you get the idea that this is sort of something Jacob's come up with. Like, oh, I'll put these magic sticks there, and the sheep will mate, and I'll get more sheep. And But look what it says. Look at chapter 31. And I have plenty to talk about next week, so I'm not depriving you by looking ahead. 31, I'm going to read verse 4 through 13. Jacob had Rachel and Leah called to the field where the flock was. So he calls his girls, calls his women out, and said to them, "I see that your father's manner toward me is not as it has been in the past, but the God of my father has been with me. As you know, I've served your father with all my might, but your father has cheated me, changing my wages time and again. God, however, would not let him do me harm." There's our Psalm 105, right? If he said thus, "The speckled shall be your wages," then all the flocks would drop speckled young. And if he said thus, "The streaked will be your wages," then all the flocks would drop streaked. God has taken away your father's livestock and given it to me. In other words, this isn't my doing. God did this. Once at the mating time of the flocks, look at this, "I had a dream in which I saw that the he-goats mating with the flock were streaked, speckled, and mottled. And in the dream, an angel of God said to me, 'Yaakov, here,' I answered. And he said, 'Note well that all the he-goats which are mating with the flock are streaked, speckled, and mottled, for I have noted all that Laban has done to you. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar and where you made a vow to me. Now arise and leave this land and return to your native land.'" So as he begins to tell Jacob it's time to go home, you're not going to go away empty-handed. Notice, Jacob, notice. Have you noticed the sheep that are mating? Have you noticed? Pay attention. And Jacob probably thought, you know, that is strange. And so he does this thing. What he's telling the girls, his wives, is, look, if God would have said all the pink sheep are yours, that all dropped out pink, it didn't matter because God is doing this. You know, I mean, have you ever stripped down a piece of wood? You know, you strip the outer bark off and you have some of the, this is what he does. And somehow it's not the stick that's magic, you know. God didn't tell him in the dream, take a spotted stick and put it before the sheep when they mate. And when they're in heat, they're going to bear. He just said, hey, Jacob, when you take a close look at this, it's the spotted and the streaked and the mottled that are mating. And he goes, well, maybe the children will be spotted. I'll tell you what I'll do, Laban. I'll take all the spotted, streaked. But it sees divinely guided. So we have to pay attention to that. Don't think that the stick had anything to do with it. But this was enough. What we learn is that this was enough, as he explains this to his women, for them to say, you know what? You're our man, and what else do we have to do with our fathers? We're going to go with you. And they're going to begin a life of their own. And so this is sort of the beginning of the end in this week's portion. It's sort of the relationship is strained. He's worn out his welcome. It's about time to move on. But we're going to see over the course of the stories that we read that God is inspiring the plan into fruition through the dreams of his people. He's showing them how things will go through dreams. It's not happening another way. I need you to get that. We think that God in the latter days will show up in our kitchen, manifest himself and say, hey, here's what I need you to do. It's probably, most likely, and I'm not prophetic here, I'm just somebody that reads Scripture. It's going to be probably much like it is here in these stories. He talks about in the latter days, I'll pour out my spirit upon all flesh, and they will dream dreams and visions. And see, right, in the book of Numbers, it says, when God speaks to someone, he does it through a dream. Makes himself known in visions and so forth and so on. Not like with Moses, but so the idea is this plan is inspired through the dreams of his people. In fact, is it Psalm 127 that when they return, the exiles return, it was as though they were living a dream. We were as those who lived a dream, you know. So we have to think it's not as we might imagine, It's very imaginative, though, because it's in the life of a dream. Psalm 137, I think. Let me make sure. Okay, we'll look it up. Someone else can look it up for me. We were as those who dream. All you great, quick Bible thinkers. Okay, so it will be guided by dream. This is the second dream of Jacob, by the way. Remember, in the first dream, when he's fleeing from his brother, he leaves, he finds a nice spot to sleep. He puts his head on a pillar, which is a rock, and he dreams a dream. And there's this ladder, and God tells him not only that about his descendants, which he doesn't have at this point, but he also says that when he goes away, that God's going with him and God's going to be with him and he'll bring him back. He also describes that his descendants would be scattered, the east, west, north, south, all those kind of things. The plan in this particular second dream, he's told basically only that you won't go out empty-handed. In the first dream, he told you're leaving your land. I'm going to tell you when it's safe to come back. I'm going to be with you when you're away. I'm going to bring you back. And in this plan, he says you're going to go away wealthy. And that's exactly what happens. So we are presented with a dream of the fathers that is given to each of them by the Creator. What we see being acted out in the lives of the fathers is guided by the dream that God gave to each of them. Now, Jeremiah 31 is sort of like one of the most incredible passages in all of prophecy. Most people know it just because they know about the Jeremiah 31, 31 through 34 in the New Covenant. But Jeremiah 31 is interesting in many ways. I talk about the white spaces and the natural break in the text. We'll probably talk a little bit about this during the dialogue. But in Jeremiah 31, there's a crying voice heard in Ramah, and bitter weeping, wailing, Rachel weeping for her sons because he's not, and so forth. And then he's told, Rachel's told, refrain yourself from weeping because your children will come back. See, this is a prophecy. It's interpreted for us. We don't have to look for a meaning for it. This is talking about the return of Joseph's descendants. And then if you look down, if you look at verse 18, the beginning of the next white space, or after the white space, I hear Ephraim lamenting. Who is Ephraim? Ephraim is the son of Joseph. So again, we have Rachel, we have Ephraim, all of these things. This is very, very prophetic, and it has to do with Joseph. Now, one thing I want to show you is there are two more sections after that, but look at verse 20. Truly, Ephraim is a dear son to me. Ephraim is called the son of God. This is Joseph's children, right? One of Joseph's sons. So this Ephraim is very, very interesting. Now, as you go down, here's the point I want to make about the dream. There's a white space after 22. So Jeremiah 31, 23 begins a final section or one of the final sections of Jeremiah 31. Listen to this. Thus says Jehovah of hosts, the God of Israel, they shall again say this in the land of Judah and in its towns when I restore their fortunes. Jehovah bless you, abode of righteousness, O holy mountain. Judah and all its towns alike shall be inhabited by the farmers and such as move about with the flocks. For I will give the thirsty abundant drink and satisfy all who languish. At this I awoke and looked about, and my sleep had been pleasant to me. And we read that as Jeremiah's dream. But who's talking? Thus says Jehovah of hosts. Now, we think, though, and we say, well, God neither sleeps nor slumbers. The image, though, is that this is God's dream. James Tabor taught this class many years ago, and it always struck me that if you follow the text, who's speaking? It's God. And he says, "And I awoke and looked about, and my sleep had been pleasant to me." There's no break in the text. It doesn't say, "And then I, Jeremiah." So the idea is that the dream of God is the very dream that he is planting in the hearts and minds of his people. Our dream has to align with the dream of God, which includes bringing all of Israel back to the land. Remember, it's the one thing in Scripture that God says he'll do with all his heart and with all his soul. He's going to plant them in this land in faithfulness. So I think that it's important that as we study and we think about this, that we consider that within the lives of the patriarchs, we see the lives of the descendants. And within the lives of the descendants, we ought to recognize that that which has been is that which shall be. So we have to study these things with the eye on what's yet to come. Probably follows the pattern laid forth in the Torah, the prophets, and the writings. Just a matter of looking at it. There's no doubt that Jacob had probably observed which sheep were mating. I mean, he probably couldn't help but it didn't really register until he's told, look closely. Did you notice that all of them are spotted? I didn't think about that. See, so sometimes it takes just look closely at what you're already seeing, and sometimes things become more obvious once someone points it out. A miraculous birth, a request to leave slavery, a dream from Jehovah to guide the people, and a guarantee that they will not leave empty-handed. Those are the four key components to this Torah portion today, and it just so happens to be a model for what takes place later in an exodus of the same people, the descendants of these very people that we read about in our text. In our next reading, we read of Israel's first exodus from slavery. Not the exodus where the sea opens up and, you know, that kind of thing. Not that one, but the one that came before. The one that served to become the footprint, if you will, for all future departures from slavery and servitude to another. So it's a theme that echoes forever throughout the Bible. Jacob is Israel. Israel is the people. And the people are more than likely you. Shabbat Shalom.